Good morning. So let me start recapitulating the motivation for the most important thing in this course, and that's the ADS-CFT conjecture due to Maldacena in 97, who conjectured that the full type 2B superstring theory on a very special background, on ADS-5 crosses 5, is dual to Super-Yang-Mills theory in flat 3 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, and so that's the central conjecture, and you can sort of motivate it by what we have doing here from the string theory, is that basically you can consider two pictures about the D-brains. One picture will be valid when gravity is very, very weak. So we had that the Newtonian potential of objects, of massive objects with extended directions, where, so the Newtonian potential was proportional to lambda, so where lambda is this Hopf coupling, and if this lambda is super, super small, then the Newtonian potential is super, super small, and so basically there is no gravity. So open string picture here, this is like no gravity picture. On the other hand, when lambda is much, much bigger, you have, you know, strong gravity picture, and so then you think about closed strings, and you think about massive objects, and, you know, black holes, black brains, and stuff like that. Okay, and so in this flat space picture, you think about these, you know, a stack of n, c, d, the three brains, and if you stack them all together so that they are all at the same place, then what actually emerges here on this stack is actually 3 plus 1 super Yang-Mills in flat space because the Newtonian potential is super small. And so we know that this super Yang-Mills is characterized by two numbers. It's characterized by the number of colors, which corresponds to the number of brains you have here. And it's characterized by the coupling constant, which is this Hopf coupling constant, lambda. Okay, so we have two constants on this side. And of course, you know, this picture will be valid only in the low energy limit, because if you start considering high energies, then you will have also massive excitations here and stuff like that. And then so it will be much more complicated. So this is fine for the low energies. So then you have the second picture, the gravitating picture, where you say, well, actually, my stack of the three brains, it looks like a normal black brain, three brain, which presumably is a solution of the equivalent gravitating theory of this. So in our case, it'll be 2B supergravity, which we have seen what it is, where we switched off all the fields except the metric and the phi form. Okay, and so it's, you should think about it like an extremely Reisner Nordström solution, basically. And if you zoom close to the horizon, you have an enhanced symmetry, you have infinite throat, which is infinitely far away from whatever happens here. And then infinite throat, you have precisely geometry ADS-5 crosses 5. These two geometries have the same radius. So the radius of S5 is the same as radius of ADS-5. But now you are still interested in the low energy limit. But you know, in this throat, like everything what happens here has to climb up the gravitational potential, and so it's losing energy. And so for these reasons, and deep in the throat, you can still consider high energetic processes, which will be seen by the outer observer as low energy because of the redshift. And so that's why in this throat, you still can consider the full, you know, fully high energetic superstring theory. So that's why you put superstring theory here. Okay? And so you also have, like, if you are very, very far away from the brain, then you have sort of like 10-dimensional Minkowski, and again you can consider some low energy modes there. But the same thing happens here. So if you are far away from this here, you again have, you know, Minkowski, and then you can consider low energy modes here. And the statement is that you can divide by these extra degrees of freedom. So that basically you divide this, you say this is the same as that, you divide that, and you say this must be then the same as that. Okay, and why you can do that is that at least here it's obvious that whatever happens in the throat, because the throat is infinitely far away from here, that it, you know, the modes here don't talk to the modes over there. Okay, and that's why you can sort of think about it like a product of whatever what happens here times whatever what happens there, and similarly here and there, and you just divide by it, and you have that conjecture. So now your superstring theory has two parameters. It's characterized by your string coupling constant and by the string length, LS. Okay, so that is the picture. But look. So you're making a conjecture that, you know, this picture is the same as that picture over here. But you are making the conjecture based on something which is valid in different regions of your parameter space. This picture is valid for lambda much, much smaller than one. And that picture is valid for lambda much, much bigger than one. So you have sort of like picture here, you have the open string picture. And so this is where this thing here is valid. And then you have another picture which is closed string picture. And it's valid over here for lambda much, much bigger than one. Okay. Nevertheless, you are saying that these two pictures will be the same for any lambda. That's why it's a conjecture. Okay. So there is no way to directly compare, you know, this thing here with that thing there, sort of. Right. So it's a conjecture. Okay. So now.
Sorry, Dave.
Yes.
I should have asked this earlier, but what is the throat?
What is the throat?
Yeah. Well,
you derive it in the tutorial, right? So it's somehow. You know, if you start zooming onto the near horizon, right? So you just take horizon and Nordstrom. Let's say the horizon is situated at r equal to 0. And you are really looking like how the geometry looks like at r equal to 0. What do you find? It looks like ADS5 cross S5. But what you can also show is that, you know, this you know, the region close, well, near horizon region, sort of, you know, grows as you are approaching extremality. So it goes far and further away from whatever happens far, far from the black hole, from when you have the Minkowski, you know, asymptotics or whatever. If you are going with Q goes to M, then suddenly, you know, this thing becomes longer and longer and has infinite proper distance from, basically the horizon is located in infinite proper distance from.
So the statement is that the singularity, the distance between the singularity and the event horizon is very large when it's extreme.
So here we are interested about the distance between the horizon and whatever happens, you know, somewhere here, right? So let's say I fix r equal to 5, right? And then r equal to 0 is the horizon. And so the distance between r equal to 5 and r equal to 0 is infinite.
Is this a feature specific to ADS black holes, like having infinite distance to the
horizon? So very good question. Thank you for that. This is not an ADS black hole. Okay, so what this is really extreme horizon and Nordstrom solution. It's asymptotically flat. So in 10 dimensions, it will be you know, asymptotically flat. You have 10D Minkowski here. It's not an ADS space. It's like normal horizon and Nordstrom. But as you are zooming onto the horizon, you get this enhanced symmetry, and somehow the ADS emerges there. Okay, and you've seen that in the extreme horizon and Nordstrom. Okay, that was just asymptotically flat horizon and Nordstrom, and nevertheless, ADS2 emerges there. The same for Kerr. If you have Kerr geometry in asymptotically flat case, if you zoom onto the horizon of the extreme black hole, you get again you get ADS2 cross something. Okay, so it's some kind of weird thing that happens, and it's like an enhancement of symmetry in this extremal throat. Yes?
So I don't know if I fully understand. When you were talking about, okay, so this is really intending 10D Minkowski space, right? And then we divide that out. What does that physically mean? Like how, because if you then divide it out, then you're not no longer looking in, you know.
You mean this type of picture or?
You were saying to relate the deep
here.
Brains to the throat, we can kind of take away the 10D Minkowski
space.
And
okay, very good. So here, okay, so what I'll be trying to tell you, right, is that you should be thinking about this four-dimensional space here as the boundary of this ADS5. That's not obvious at all at this point, right? So that's not obvious. So, you know, in this picture, you're just choosing, you know, some kind of sheet which floats in your high-dimensional space, and you say, this is my world. I live on this 3 plus 1-dimensional world because, you know, I'm confined to live on this brain. So what do I see? Right, and if you live in this 3 plus 1 dimensional world, you see you know, this type of theory living there, right? And you don't need to care about 10 dimensional Minkowski, right? You just are confined to the brain, so this is your world. you live in 3+1 dimensions, and the theory which governs your physics is this one.
I think the thing that's bothering me is the fact that it's like, I don't know, it's kind of like, it's like, oh wow, maybe it's really connected to flat space, but it's 10-dimensional, and then we're taking away the flat space part, so it's still going back to like, you know, kind of an ADS space, and it's
yeah.
Like sad.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, look at this from the point of view of the observer in the brain, and look at that from the point of observer who lives in this throat, right? And somehow the statement is that these two things should be equivalent. This is a motivation, okay? Yes.
Should I think of the brains as being the boundary of the throat?
As the brains being the boundary of the throat. Sure. You can. Yeah, precisely. So you know, you'd be saying sort of, you know, the boundary of your ADS5, you know, will be where our 3+1 thing lives, right? So really, you should be thinking as this thing here, as the boundary of your ADS5, right? And so then, yeah, if you want, you can think about it that way. Yeah. All right. So now, why this conjecture is super amazing, right? It's super amazing because, on one hand, so you know, it's a conjecture, it's a duality between two theories, right? Duality means complete equivalence, including all quantum corrections and everything. So by the way, we have also derived how, otherwise it wouldn't be a duality, right? So we know how the parameters of this theory translate into the parameters of that theory. And we derived that by comparing, like, you know, as we're saying, this massive thing has to correspond to the stack of these three brains. And then so we derived it yesterday. We know that the GS, you know, the string theory parameters on the left-hand side, L over LS, and GS are given in terms of the parameters of the Yang-Mills theory on the right-hand side. Okay, so that's why we know how to translate one theory exactly into the other theory. And so that's very important. Now let's have several remarks. And so the first remark is that duality, so we say dual, but that means, that was correct, means complete equivalence. At the full quantum level, the Hilbert spaces are the same, the dynamics is the same, and stuff like that. Okay, so that's what is conjectured. So typically, be warned, okay? Typically, when you have a duality, right? You have seen probably many dualities already. Duality is just a change of variables, right? So I use, you know, certain degrees of freedom. Now, in one theory, now I change variables. I know how to translate these degrees of freedom to something else. And then I have a new theory with this new degrees of freedom. And you know, these two theories are obviously equivalent because I know how to change variables from one theory to another. Okay, here we don't know. So no explicit change of variables is known though. Okay, so really this is still a conjecture because nobody found how to change variables from super young males, where your variables are the scalar field phi and the Yang-Mills field a mu, to the gravitational degrees of freedom on the right hand side. So you know, type 2B super string has gravitons in it. So yeah, somehow you have to change the Yang-Mills degrees of freedom to gravitational degrees of freedom. Nobody knows how to do that. In fact, there are theorems that it cannot be done. Right? But these are theorems which typically say, well, I have given space-time or whatever, and then can I mimic gravity by doing something with other spins, right? Can I mimic spin 2 field by considering bunch of, I don't know, spin 1 and other fields? And the statement is you cannot. But this is not what we are doing here. We are doing something completely different. Our Yang-Mills lives in 3+1. Our gravitational theory lives on ADS5 cross S5. It's not the same space. It's very, very different, right? So because of this, you know, change of the background or whatever, maybe it is possible. Okay, so no change of variables is known. But what is very important is that we relate a theory of quantum gravity of, and this is why people love it, right? Gravity to non-gravitational quantum field theory, right? And so this is really amazing that we have some kind of, you know, gravity on the right-hand side and we have no gravity on the left-hand side, yet the duality says that we have the same theories, right? Yes?
Can you explain better, like, what do you mean by change of variables? Because when I think about equivalence, what I think is there is, like, another kind of computation that I can map, like, on one side to the other side. So as long as I can map this observable to some observable,
that's exactly, yeah, exactly. So the simplest duality, electromagnetic duality, right? You know that I have to map E to B and B to minus E, and then my theory, you know, becomes the same.
It's very explicit, but then what you're saying is that you cannot find
something. You cannot find it here, yeah, at this point. So you don't know how to translate degrees of freedom of super young males to degrees of gravity and whatever. So, yeah, so there's no, like, you cannot make this change of variables explicitly. Okay, so this is why people love it. Like, you do something with gravity and you relate it to non-gravitational QFT. Yes.
We have the black hole metric, but I don't see why it should be a theory of quantum gravity, which is.
So the superstring theory has gravitons in it. So it's a theory of quantum gravity, right? So it is consistent theory of quantum gravity because, you know, your type 2B string actually has gravitons and you quantize it and everything is fine and consistent. So for this reason, you would say it's a theory of quantum gravity described by superstring theory. And now this is dual to your super young males. Yes?
But in the tutorial, we saw the duality between ADS2 process 2 without doing like super gravity. We were just working with the black.
Right. Very good. Let me get back to you in tutorial or something like that. So of course, you know, so this is the original conjecture, like, but then you can start extending this to other space times as well, and maybe there is flat space holography, maybe there is other things. So people go much more general than, well, at least they, so they haven't proved this, right? And they go much, much beyond this. Anyway, so yeah.
Sorry's question. If we claim that the what we have is correspondence between quantum gravity and young males, on the quantum gravity side, the metric could fluctuate dynamically to such an extent that we lose the ADS5 process.
That's a good point as well, yes. So anyway, we'll be using it in you know, much more restricted setting. So you know, this is a completely general conjecture. It's like super strong conjecture, which nobody uses, don't worry. So we will weaken it, but it will still be useful. Okay, and then we you know, it will answer your question. Okay? Yes?
Also, I think, like, from what I remember in this book, that they say that, well, they're showing this one, right? But then they claim that it's actually valid for kinetic states, right? And in that case, you have a quantum string theory, actually, not mm-hmm. classical string theory. So it makes sense that you are.
So that's why this is only a motivation, right?
Yeah.
So the conjecture is much more general, as I stated it here, right? But yeah, so you're fixing the background there. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So why this can work, why there can be a connection between, you know, quantum gravity and quantum field theory, as I said, there is no-go theorems which say that it cannot be done. So why this can work is that the duality is actually holographic, meaning that you know, we can think about that the super young males lives on the boundary of ADS5. And so it is, in that sense, it's holographic, like whatever happens in the ADS5. So this is like completely ignoring the sphere, right? So we have ADS 5 crosses 5. The sphere is typically boring, but it has some consequences, right? But anyway, so if you forget about the sphere at this point, let's say it's boring, and I don't care about what's happening in the sphere, then you can say, well, on the boundary of ADS 5, I have, as we shall see, flat Minkowski space, and that's where my CFT will live. And in that sense, like whatever happens on the boundary has to correspond to whatever happens in the bulk of ADS 5. Okay, so this is one comment. Okay, so that's that. And you know, we shall study ADS. So don't worry, if you are not familiar with ADS, I will show you that really you can think about the boundary of ADS sometimes as flat Minkowski space. You will see that. Okay. So now you may be asking, well, I don't want to deal with type 2B super. Well, okay. So this conjecture is amazing, right? But you don't understand n equal to 4 super Young Mills, right? You don't understand. And you don't understand, certainly don't understand type 2B super string theory, right? So basically, it's a conjecture between two theories which you don't understand. And so for this reason, people try to weaken this and to see, like, to get something more familiar, something that they understand better. And one thing is that you can really take the classical limit of this superstring theory to get classical type 2B supergravity, which is like the normal gravity with extra fields, right? Classical one. And then people understand that. So let's ask when this happens. Okay, so classical supergravity is valid when first stringy corrections are suppressed. What I mean by this is that I want to say that, like, strings are small, are point-like. Okay. So if you have teeny tiny strings, they look like particles. Okay. And so then suddenly you don't talk about, you know, weird geometry of strings, but you talk about the normal standard geometry in GR as you know it with point particles. Okay, so when this happens, well, it happens when the length of the string is small, right? When the length of the string is small, in other words, if you have that ratio L over LS, L is the radius of your space-time of ADS 5, right? So if L over LS is much, much bigger than 1, then, you know, these strings will look like point-like in our geometry. So so when L over LS is much bigger than 1, okay, but then look at beautiful thing here. We know what L over LS is. It's given by lambda. Okay, so from here, you find that lambda must be much, much bigger than 1. So second, you say that the quantum gravity corrections are small. What I mean by the second statement, so this is stringy corrections, strings are point-like. What I mean by this is that you can neglect quantum effects of splitting strings and interacting strings and stuff like that. So you can just have, you know, free strings, basically. Okay, and so you suppress the loops of strings and you know, these Penty diagrams and so on. And so this will happen when the interaction constant, the string interaction constant, is much, much smaller than 1, right? So this is what you mean by at the string context, that you just suppress the interactions and, you know, creating loops of strings and stuff like that. But we know what GS is. It's lambda over NC, okay? Which means that lambda over NC is much, much smaller than 1. It means that lambda is much, much smaller than NC. But from here, you already know that lambda is much, much bigger than 1. So if you put 1 and 2 together, 1 plus 2, you get that 1 is much, much smaller than lambda, which is much, much smaller than nc. Okay. And so now you have on the right-hand side, you have theory which you understand. It's just the classical, weak, you know, gravitational theory with extra fields, right? But now what it means for the left-hand side, it means that lambda, the coupling of your Young-Mills theory, is super, super strong. And moreover, your Young-Mills actually has infinite number of colors, right? So it's not like QCD or whatever, but it, this has to be large, and this has to be large. Okay, but what it means is that we have strong, weak coupling duality. Okay, so from here, you have strong, weak coupling duality. Namely, the classical supergravity, classical and weak gravity described by 2B supergravity is now equivalent, is dual to a strongly coupled CFT. Okay. And this is precisely the context people have been using this duality most of the time. So on one hand, you have now a theory of gravity, supergravity, which is well understood. Right? It's just normal gravity, as you know it, normal GR plus extra fields. But somehow, the calculations in this weak gravity tell you what happens in the strongly coupled QFT, for the strongly coupled super Young-Mills. And of course, that's amazing, right? Because people typically do perturbation expansion for quantum field theory, right? But it's only for weak coupling, right? So you cannot do perturbation expansion of quantum field theory if you have strong coupling. But somehow, you can now do calculation for strongly coupled CFT by doing some simple calculations on the gravity side, right? And so that's how people have been using this duality. Okay. Another warning here. So, as I said, this is a conjecture. Nobody knows how to prove it, right? There is an evidence that this might work actually. Okay, and the evidence is not that I would know how to change the variables from one to another, but I can study case by case cases where maybe I can calculate both sides of this. In very special cases, I can calculate things here, and I can calculate things there. And then I can compare the results, and I will get the same thing. So it's I would say the conjecture is supported by case evidence. Okay, so have that in mind, right? So it may be the case that for the cases people studied, it really worked, but miraculously for some strange reasons, and that maybe this is not true in general. Okay, so what typically people use as an argument that this must be so is that they match the symmetries of the theory on one side, and they match the symmetries on the of the theory on the other side. So as a quick check, check the symmetries. And so, ADS 5 crosses 5 you'll see today that ADS is a maximally symmetric space. And so ADS 5 has SO4 2 symmetry. Okay, so it's like, yes, we will see it today. SO4 2 symmetry, and S5 has SO6 symmetry. Okay, SO6 symmetry. Okay, so that's the symmetry on the gravity side. On the other hand, the super young males, it's a CFT, and you will see it in tomorrow's tutorial, that CFT in D equal to 4, CFT in D equal to 4 dimensions, and you will see that there are, you know, that many generators and stuff like that, and that has again SO4 2 symmetry. What I haven't told you is that, you know, our particle CFT has 6 scalar fields. Okay, the N equal to 4 super young has 6 scalar fields, and what you can do is that there is an extra symmetry where you basically take these 6 scalar fields and rotate them into each other. Okay, and so that's where the other SO6 emerges, so rotation of scalar fields of 6 scalar fields. Okay, so as a quick check, the symmetries on one side actually match the symmetries on the other side. And you know, it's typically the symmetry arguments which lead everything, right? So if I can say that something, you know, has the symmetries on the left side and something has the same symmetries on the right side, then the dictionary tells you these are the same objects. That's, you know, how you start building the dictionary. Okay. Questions? Isn't this amazing? The biggest development of theoretical physics in past 20, 30 years, right? It's this thing here. Yes?
Those scalar fields are perpendicular to, they don't live on the D planes. And when we say we have a rotational symmetry, we mean that we are compacting from the extra symmetry.
No. You will, so they, first of all, they will live on the D plane, right? So your super young males consist of, you know, vector A mu, right? And which has 2 degrees of freedom. And then it consists of 6 scalars, right, which has another 6 degrees of freedom, so you have 8 bosonic degrees of freedom. Your theory has also fermions, it has 4 wild fermions, each of them 2 degrees of freedom, so 8 fermionic degrees of freedom, so that's why it's matching between fermionic and whatever, but the scalars and the vectors and everything lives on the brain.
Here, when you mentioned classical and weak gravity, you said that there are like extra fields there, what do you mean?
Yeah. So you know, remember when like 2 lectures ago I wrote down the action for the type 2b supergravity, right? So that had like the Einstein-Hilbert term as the first leading thing, but then it has, you know, some extra scale fields like dilaton, and it has you know, the Kalp-Ramon field, and it has the 3-form and 5-form and stuff like that. So it's like, so it's gravity plus extra fields. That's what, you know, and there's fermions as well because it's a supergravity. So you know, it's a complicated, but it's still like a classical gravity if you want, right? And so yeah.
The SO6 symmetry. I'm sorry, I missed it, but the SO6 symmetry is coming from the supersymmetry?
So, here?
Oh, and the
so here it comes from the S5, so that's the symmetry of S5. And here, this is the symmetry of CFT in 4 dimensions, so this comes from here. So you will see it in the tutorial tomorrow. And then this SO6 comes from the fact that your theory has 6 scalar fields, and you can rotate one to another. Yeah. Okay, very good. So let me stop about the conjecture here, and let me just say a few words about the CFT, because otherwise you will not be say, well, this is amazing when we derive 2-point function from this ADS CFT duality. If you don't know how the 2-point function in CFT looks like, then you will not appreciate it, right? So a few remarks. On CFT. So basically, conformal field theory, so CFT is a field theory, field theory with extra space-time symmetries. And why you care particularly about CFT is because it's non-trivial, but it has enhanced symmetry. So it is more symmetric than your standard Poincaré invariant gauge theory. It has an extra symmetry which you impose now, but it's still non-trivial. It can still interact and stuff like that. And so there is a theorem saying that that conformal symmetry is the largest one for non-trivial meaning interacting QFTs. Okay, so typically when you try to solve something, you try to put as much symmetry as you can, but if you put too much symmetry, then everything becomes trivial. So this is putting good symmetry, which is still non-trivial result. Okay, so CFTs are good, and so in D dimensions, CFT is invariant under SO2D conformal transformations. So what are these? So you can think about them. It's like when you study, Poincaré symmetry, right? So what do? So you say, well, I allow such coordinate transformations so that my Minkowski metric remains invariant under this. So now you do the same thing. So you do a coordinate transformation x mu to x prime mu of x, such that your Minkowski metric now does not remain invariant, eta mu nu, but can be arbitrarily rescaled. Okay, so this is, so you'll call such a coordinate transformation a conformal transformation if the Minkowski metric preserves up to a total scaling, right? But you know that the Minkowski metric, it sort of measures angles between things and stuff like that, but the angles actually, so distances may change, right? Distances may change. You can rescale the distance, but the angles, relative angles, will remain the same. Okay, so preserves local angles, but it can change the distances. So the conformal transformations. Basically, well, if you have omega equal to 1, it's still a conformal transformation. But if omega is equal to 1, this is just Poincaré. So are the Poincaré transformations Poincaré plus scalings plus, let me put first this one, plus something which is called special conformal, which we will not need. And plus scalings, scaling transformations. And so what the scaling transformation is that if you go t to lambda t and x to lambda x, where lambda is a constant, or it need not be, then if your field transforms as prime x prime, as lambda minus delta phi of x, then, and this is a symmetry of your action, then you say it's invariant under scaling transformations. Okay. So you will derive all these things in your tutorial tomorrow. Don't worry. So you will see that really requiring this it gives you not only Poincaré, but it gives you, you know, the scaling thing, but it also gives you something else, and that something else is called special conformal transformation. Okay, so now this delta is called scaling dimension. And so in some sense, you know that in Poincaré theory, you can characterize things, you know, according to their momentum and according to the spin and stuff like that. So now there'll be another parameter here that, you know, you will have to say what is the scaling dimension of your given field. Okay, so that's an extra property of your scalar field which you put there. Okay. So now just some examples of conformal field theories. And so in Minkowski they are typically the massless fields. So the fact that, you know, if you have mass, it will break the conformal symmetry. You can think about that. But basically, you know, having a mass means you have given scale. Right? If you give a scale, then if you rescale things, and the scale, well, you cannot have the symmetry. Right? So you cannot have massive objects. And so examples of conformal theory as well, Maxwell theory, right? D mu, F mu equals to zero. Massless Dirac. Gamma mu, D mu on psi equals to zero. Lambda to the 4 theory. So you have box on phi equals to lambda over 3 factorial phi cube. So lambda to the 4 is, of course, in the Lagrangian. So that's why if you write down the equations of motion, it will be phi cube. Classical Young-Mills. Let's just write it like this, FPU equals to zero. Well, this guy here, well, okay, let's write it like that. So that's classically, right? So now, if you are interested whether this symmetry is preserved quantum mechanically, you look at the corresponding beta functions in the RG flow, and if the beta function is equal to zero, then the symmetry is preserved quantum mechanically. Okay, and so these two actually are not conformal, not quantum mechanically. So if you want to preserve quantum mechanically, you require that your beta function is equal to zero for your coupling constants. Okay? Okay, and the last thing I want to mention about these, well, okay, maybe two things. So one thing is that, of course, the conformal symmetry restricts the form of endpoint functions okay. So for example, you know that if you consider a two-point function and you have Poincaré invariant theory, then it must be the function must be just function of x minus y okay. And so for the conformal symmetry, if you So this has Poincaré invariant, so it must be if you consider a two-point function, OX or Y, okay. So this must be function of X minus Y, but you can also use the scaling, and it's just one line proof that you can show that this is proportional to 1 over X minus Y, and if lambda is the scaling dimension of your operator O, then this is given by x minus y to 2 lambda. Okay? You can show that, just show it. One line proof, okay? You just use the scaling symmetry of your field, and this is what you get. Okay? And so we need to, I need to mention this, because when we will derive, you know, the two-point function from some crazy calculation on the gravity side, well, you need to know that when we get 1 over x minus y to 2 delta, we are actually on the right track. Okay? So very good. Last thing I want to mention about these, you know, conformal field theories is that they are useful, just on their own, useful. And for example, they'll be useful, as you've seen probably in your statistical physics, for phase transitions. So for example, if you have second order phase transition, then this is described by conformal field theory. And you know that it's characterized by some critical exponents and stuff like that. And these critical exponents are precisely connected to the scaling dimensions of your fields. Okay, so there's this like alpha, beta, whatever, translates to the scaling dimensions of the corresponding CFT describing your phase transition. You also know that string theory, we have seen that it's a two-dimensional conformal field theory. So it is described by CFT. And so if you want to understand, you know, all the miracles about string theory, you study CFT. It's also useful for mapping space of QFTs. You know that you can have some RG flows in the QFT space and whatever, but then you have fixed points, and the fixed points precisely correspond to your CFT, and you can sort of think about various QFTs as perturbations from CFTs. Okay, questions about this? So if you have taken some course on CFT, you know, and this is probably like first 5 minutes, but this will be sufficient for us what we need in this course. Okay, so. So very good. So it's good to study conformal field theory, because it is useful for various things. No questions? Then let me talk also about ADS. So we now know what CFT is. Let's talk about ADS. And so an annoying thing about ADS is that it has so many coordinate systems, you can write it down, and people do, and these various coordinate systems are useful for different things, right? And so what it is, so ADS-D is a maximally symmetric solution of Einstein equations with negative cosmological constant. Okay. And it has symmetry O d minus 1. Okay, so this is ADS-D. So in D dimensions, you have this type of symmetry here. Okay, and so as I said, you know, various coordinate systems, various pictures about ADS are useful in various settings. So let me just convince you that really it's a maximally symmetric space. Okay, and so that's done in the picture of embedding, where you basically, you will see that, well, nobody doubts that flat space is maximally symmetric space, right? What about a sphere? If you have a sphere, x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals to l squared, is that maximally symmetric? Does it have the same number of Killing vectors as flat space? What do you think? it does, right? It's just, you know, the embedding is slightly different. So now what about hyperboloid? Hyperboloid is the same thing, but now you just, you know, swap some signs and whatever in the definition, and so hyperboloid will be also maximally symmetric. So now that's basically what ADS space is. It's a hyperboloid, but now in a weird spacetime with two times. Okay, so again you're swapping some signs. Okay, so ADSD. So okay, ADS D as maximally symmetric space. Symmetric space. And so we will do the embedding here. And so basically you consider, so take something like weird Minkowski spacetime, right? So you take two times, so R with two times and D minus one spatial directions, okay? And so this will be equipped with the metric, which, well, I will have y minus 1 square minus d y 0 square. And that will be pluses. Y d minus 1 square. OK. That's my weird metric in this, you know. It's a flat space, but now with strange signature, right? And so this is like eta ab. I have two times. The rest is normal. Dya, dyb. Okay, so we have just the flat space with two strange times. Okay, this is time, that is time. And then you take, in this flat space, you take hyperboloid by preserving, you know, the symmetry. This symmetry of minus minus, but because it's a hyperboloid, so for sphere it will be L square equals to x square plus y square plus z square. So now we have this strange minuses, so it's minus L square is minus y1 square minus y0 square plus the rest plus y1 square plus y d minus 1 square. Okay, so again this is our eta AB to D minus 1 YA YB. Okay, so this is some kind of hypersurface. It looks like a hyperboloid, but it's a hyperboloid. So it's a hyperboloid. But it's a hyperboloid in Minkowski space with two times. Okay? Okay, very good. So now, what is the metric on my ADS space then? Is that I have to solve this constraint. So this is my hyperboloid, like whatever. So I solve it, let's say, for y minus 1. Okay, so y minus 1, from here, you find that y minus 1 is L square. So it's L square. Plus eta AB YA YB, where this eta AB is now this thing here, it's a normal metric. So it's 1 D minus 1, 1 D minus 1 AB, and then square root of that. Okay. And so dy minus 1. So you just differentiate this, and so it will be 1 over square root of this, and then eta AB VB DVB. Okay. And you plug it here, and that's how you get the metric of the ADS space. Okay? And so from here, you find if you plug it over there, that G AB. it will be this piece here, which is eta ab, with 1 minus time and other is plus, it's eta ab, plus the piece which I get from here, so that thing here square. Okay, so it's minus yA yB L square plus eta AB yA yB. Okay, and that's the metric on ADS space. One possible metric. It's the embedding viewpoint. You are really embedding a strange hyperboloid into the space-time is two times. Yes?
What happens if we try to embed in R1, D instead of 2, D minus
1? Say it again. If you're trying, what? 1, D minus?
1 with D-dimensional space.
You would one D? Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So then you would be embedding in the Minkowski space. I'm sure it's useful. What does it give you? It must give you something.
Sitter.
It must be, yeah.
You can get to Sitter if you embed
the hyperboloid. Ah, very good. Yeah. So the Sitter will have one time. Yeah, right. So the Sitter will have one time. So, but probably, I'm not sure if this minus sign is there.
The
sign. So anyway, you just start playing with the signs. But certainly, 1D minus 1D will lead to some interesting space-time. And I think, right, it must be the Sitter or something like that, right? But you see how screwed up the anti-de Sitter is, right? It's screwed up because you start with two times. and so really, when you try to plot it as a hyperboloid, your hyperboloid lives in this high-dimensional space with two times. And that's bad, right? Why is it bad? Well, if you move on that hyperboloid, there's two times, and in those directions, you will have time, closed time-like curves. Okay, so subtracting time directions is good. Adding more time directions is a disaster. Okay, so let's have a picture, and we have the last 2 minutes. So let's do picture of ADS2. Picture ADS2. So basically, we are now embedding in the three-dimensional space with two times. Okay, so there will be this thing here, y0 will be, let's say, time 1, right? And there will be y minus 1, which is time 2, right? And then there will be y1, which is the spatial direction here. And then what you are really getting in this picture is the normal hyperboloid. So this will be like that. It will be like that. It looks like this. Okay. So this is so the surface of that hyperboloid, or the hyperboloid, is your ADS2, right? But now look, what if I follow a trajectory like this, right? So this trajectory like this, it just goes up in this direction y0, and it goes in this direction of y minus 1, right? So you know, this thing here, it just moves in time 1 and time 2. So this is actually time-like. Okay, so this is a closed time-like curve. Okay, so actually, anti-de Sitter space is bad in the sense that you allow for closed time. Like I said, if you follow a trajectory like this, you just move in time only, basically. But you end up in the same place as you started with, and you can kill your grandfather. And so that's bad, right? So very good. So ADS2 is this hyperboloid, but we have this problem over here. So how people say, you know, yeah?
I'm sorry, I don't.
So how people actually fix this is that they say, well, okay, I start here, I go all the way here, I come back, but it's a different hyperboloid. So they actually go to a covering space, and they say, well, now I start winding on the on a new sheet of the hyperboloid, and I wind and wind around, but they never come to the same place because I am putting more and more sheet of the hyperboloid. Okay, so to avoid this, quite this. People consider covering space and so basically you might think that the angle here goes from, I don't know, 0 to 2 pi, like if I parameterize this closed line curve from 0 to 2 pi angle, but then you suddenly say, well, my angle actually doesn't go from 0 to pi, it goes from minus infinity to infinity. And then I'm sort of, you know, covering space, and I don't know how to say that. They put more and more hyperboloid like that. Okay, so this is one way how you can deal with this. Last thing I want to say, if you take this metric, plug it in your Mathematica, Maple, well, you'll find that indeed this solves Einstein equations. In fact, what you'll find is that R A B C D, the Riemann tensor, is given by minus 1 over L squared, and now the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, minus G A D G B C. Okay. So this is how the Riemann tensor looks like. Whenever you find that the Riemann tensor looks like this, you know you have a maximally symmetric space. And then if you contract this, and then if you consider GAB plus lambda GAB, you find that this is equal to 0. There is no energy momentum tensor, but the lambda will be given by minus d minus 1, d minus 2, divided by 2L squared. Okay? So it is indeed a solution of Einstein equations with negative cosmological constant. But it is also maximally symmetric. Well, how it comes from is that you see that the metric is like, you know, a Minkowski metric, but just with a special tie. The embedding equation is given by the same Minkowski metric, right? We know that the normal Minkowski metric has Lorentz transformations as symmetry, as the corresponding symmetry. So this is a Lorentz. So the corresponding thing will be like a Lorentz transformation, except now we allow for different time. So both the constraint and metric. You know, in R 2d minus 1 are invariant under Lorentz, something like Lorentz transformations, which have screwed up signature. So invariant, oh, this is not good. And then you would just write the standard Lorentz thing. So eta AB 2d minus 1 equals to eta cd 2d minus 1 lambda, like a Lorentz transformation, ca lambda db. Well, this is like a Lorentz transformation, but now this is the corresponding signature. And then you can write this infinitesimally. We'll find that the corresponding infinitesimal thing has to be antisymmetric. But it's antisymmetric in d plus 1 dimensions. So the symmetry group is d plus 1 over 2 is the symmetry group, is the number of generators. And that's the number of symmetries. So in particular, if you are in 4 dimensions, this will have 10 killing vectors. But for flat space, it's also 10 killing vectors. It's like the flat space here. So this is the number of symmetries. So indeed, ADS is a maximally symmetric space, and you can think about it as a hyperboloid. In order to avoid, you know, time-like closed directions, you can wind the hyperboloid many times, and that's what ADS is. Okay? Questions? Yes.
I don't see why there is a problem with the winding.
There's no problem with the winding. You can do it. Yes.
No. In the sense that I don't see why we need it, because all physics is being done on the surface of the, like, inside the embedding, right?
Yeah.
So there's only one time like direction, and there's no possibility of closed.
Yeah, but it's somehow, well, you could probably say I just restrict to, you know, one. Yeah, maybe you could say that. Would that cause any troubles? I don't know if that caused any troubles. Certainly, you know, it's like you will see next time we will have different picture of ADS, and you will see, you know, what kind of, you know, which part, you know, the hyperbolt covers, and it's just, you know, one slice of the cylinder, of the ADS cylinder, and people just consider the whole cylinder. And it's convenient to have time not compactified or not finite, but to have time which goes from minus infinity to infinity, right? So I think it's desirable to put the covering sheet, but yeah. Is that another question? Yeah.
You know, the usual picture people draw, if they want to draw something like simple, like ADS3, they draw a cylinder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on that cylinder, they say, okay, you have a radius, you have an angle, and then you have time. But that seems like there's only one time dimension. So how does that kind of correspond?
We will see next time, okay? So what is your question? We will definitely get to that picture as well. So we will get there, but you know, so it's this embedding picture is very nice for reconstructing symmetries of the ADS. That cylinder picture is a global ADS, and then it will be useful for something else. But the symmetries are not so obvious, I would say, because suddenly now you split it into time and some kind of sphere or whatever. But then it's not obvious that really you have all these symmetries there, right? So you know, each coordinate system, each picture is useful for something else, and unfortunately, you need to know all. So yeah, we'll get back to that.
ADS has SO4, 2. ADS 5 has SO4, 2 symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Does it need to be special? Because from here, it seems it can be just orthogonal.
So this thing here, precisely, you know, you can see that it has, you know, SOD-1, 2 symmetry or whatever, from here. Now you are asking if ADS 5 is special. Well.
This could be O4, 2. Why is it SO4, 2?
This could be SO.
Just the orthogonal group, not the special
orthogonal. It's because of this of these two times, right? So this thing here will have SO, 2D-1, because I said our space time is d-dimensional. Right, so this thing here, if it's four-dimensional, this doesn't work. What's wrong here? Because you're not talking about ADS5, yeah. So this thing here is like rotations, right? But the rotations have two times in them, so that's why it's this 2, something.
Something that I'm not convinced with is like ADS5 has SO4, 2, CFD in 4D has SO4, 2. S5 will have a 6, but I really don't see why exactly we should have 6 scalars and why there should be a rotation in the field of scalars and why that is SO6.
Well, it's like rotation in the 6-dimensional space, right? And that has SO6, right?
Space of scalar fields.
Yeah.
But why exactly do we have 6 scalar fields?
It's just how the theory looks like, right? So you know, you can construct, and of course the n equal to 4 super Youngbus was known much before ADS CFT, right? So it was studied long before, and so it's simply this one here happens to have 6 scalar fields and happens to have a vector field. But how you do it, how you see that from the point of view of these brains, right? So the scalar fields really correspond to the extra direction. So now you live in 10 dimensions, right? And you single out 4 dimensions by putting the brain there, and so you have 6 dimensions left. Right, and that precisely corresponds to the Dirichlet directions. And this precisely corresponds to 6 scalar fields. Okay. Okay.
Maximally symmetric space times. The Riemann tensor will always look like that.
Yes, exactly. So whenever you find that, there may be something standing here different, but it will always look like product of these two metrics.
And the difference between positively curved and negatively curved is the sign in front of that.
Yeah, exactly. So if you had like the DS space would look like that. Exactly. Very good. Okay. See you on Friday. No, see you tomorrow.